Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is June 30th, 2016. Half of the year is gone. Only, about 180 shopping days till Christmas. Oh my goodness. Anyway, we're in a time warp here. No question about it. A quick notice, you will be finding advertisements for my water filters in other websites and mainly talk show hosts who I'm a guest on their shows regularly, and these will be appearing more and more. Feel free to click on those and shop, because what it does is it supports those radio shows also, or those hosts, those people. And so it's a program I've set up, very limited in scope, very selectively chosen, the various people that are in that program. So at any rate, check that out. And if you see those ads for JMCC water filters on other pages, feel free to click on those, because those people, it helps them out too, as they get a commission. And so, anyway, and if you have a favorite radio show where you listen regularly, tell them and say, contact Jim McCanny so we can buy the water filters through them and support them also. So anyway, that's just a little, it's part of a new program to, in a sense, expand my horizons. The fires and the floods in the Northeast, the floods and the various fires, people have been writing in about those, asking about those, and I really have not been able to formulate a verdict on whether these are man-made or, you know, what exactly the story, what exactly is going on. When you see total disinformation, for example, I saw an article that came out in Scientific America, and they were Johnny on the spot to publish this, and they had some kind of a study, one of the global warming studies. These people flip and change by, you know, faster than flipping a coin. But the study allegedly said that since global warming existed, then there would be more evaporation of water, which was, by the way, a Velikovsky realization back in the 50s, there would be more moisture in the air, therefore floodings. And then they said the northeastern states, beginning with West Virginia up into Maine, would be more prone to higher rain activity. And so then they point an arrow to West Virginia and say, oh, that could be the cause. Not mentioning anything about any of the other states in that block of states in the Northeast, none of which have severe flooding like West Virginia. And as if magically the water just showed up at West Virginia. And so once again, the loosely, extremely loosely empirical correlation between global warming in some event, but it gets passed off in Scientific America. That just shows you the complete blanket coverage of this kind of complete baloney through standard science and its mouthpieces, which include Scientific America, Discover Magazine, National Geographic, Sky and Telescope, Astronomy Magazine, all of these mouthpieces just filled to the brim with fairy tale science, especially written for you, the public. This was sent in by a listener, and it's called We the Prisoners. And it says, the demise of the Fourth Amendment. And this is written by John Whitehead via the Rutherford Institute. It says, our carceral state, meaning a prison state, banishes American citizens to a gray wasteland far beyond the promises and protections the government grants its other citizens. When the doors finally close and one finds oneself facing banishment to a carceral state, the years, the walls, the rules, the guards, the inmates, the incarcerated begins to adjust to the fact that he or she is indeed a prisoner. New social ties are cultivated, new rules must be understood. And by the way, if you haven't noticed, one of Hillary Clinton's speeches, she calls for all adults in the United States to go to happy school, is what she calls it. And this is right out of 1984, where they're basically re-education camps. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because the music industry is jumping on this. There are songs, and of course, very well written, very much populist, you know, pleasing to listen to. But they have a symbol that's tattooed on a mother and her baby or little girl, and they wake up, and the mother goes running out. She walks down the street, and like everybody is in awe, watching her walk down the street. And like this is the theme of the video, and she is. Goes to a concert and everybody is screaming and obliterately happy and oblivious to everything because they're so happy, and it's like a concert with, you know, people jumping up and down, and it's one of the concerts where there's no musicians. It's all boom, 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 that kind of music. And a disco players, you know, how the people playing discos now are part of the scene and they're jumping up and down. Everybody's jumping up and down and totally euphoric and happy. And this is the video. And it keeps showing this symbol, which is a tattooed on her as being part of the basically the new world culture, the one world culture. And these are the happy farms. This is what Hillary Clinton is talking about. They would have concerts, they would have music, and then everybody would be part of a re-education program to understand how happy you should be in your prison state. And it's part of that euphoria, you know. So anyway, I just want you to understand that this is coming down the pike. And so I don't know where other things, you know... I just said a long time ago, in fact, when I was on Joyce Riley's show the last time, it was in early June. I was at about the 8th of June, 7th, somewhere in there. It was the second Wednesday of June. I forget the date, second hour. But anyway, I made mention that, and on previous shows also I made mention that summertime, we were heading in for summertime 2016, we're headed in for a real roller coaster ride. There are reports that have come from John Moore, my friend, co-host. I'm on his show every Wednesday morning. But he has observed that UN trucks, or people have observed, and he was mentioning that UN trucks are moving around the United States at night. And these are fairly big armored personnel carriers, and obviously they're not filled with flowers to deliver at your floor, at your door. So it looks like, and by the way, the Orlando shooting appears to be a part of the ongoing Operation Jade Helm, which is literally a military operation on American soil. But when they do these training operations, they're not training operations. They sometimes turn into real events and staged events, etc. So, by the way, there's a book coming out shortly on Orlando. There's been a good deal of actual hardcore research done on this. And so I'm looking forward to the presentation of that book, Keep Your Eyes Out. I don't have a title or a release date yet. The final title I don't have in my hands yet. But watch for that because it's very important. Of course, there are lawsuits. I don't know if you've heard about this. $1 trillion lawsuits spread around the media network corporations that involve media. spreading the disinformation about Sandy Hook, that it was a shooting and all these kids died. And the reality is that it was an operation. And all of these people are smug as smug can be. The real investigations, and you can see this, a lot of videos on this. Jim Fetzer has been one of the primary spearheads, writing a book called Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. And so, you know, and then Obama uses an empty chair in his State of the Nation speech, an empty chair representing the dead children at Sandy Hook. I even know people that still say, well, we know somebody that knew somebody that knew somebody that died there, or their kids did. And it's like, you know, they, just like Orlando, they can spin these news stories to high heaven. And I watch foreign news feeds, and they're singing songs, and they're trying to get a lot of mileage out of these events. So, at any rate, just keep your eyes open. But I certainly hope it doesn't come to, you know, individuals at their house, you know, having to shoot it out with UN goons trying to slam their door down, collecting arms or something like that. Just remember, it was not citizens in their home with their arms that created ISIS or the Iraq War or Afghanistan War or destroyed Libya. This was the U.S. government. And they are literally, they're your enemy. You are their enemy. And the reason they're your enemy is because all people in the United States have been declared enemies of the state. So by virtue of that, they're your enemy. And there's nothing good or about it. It's really a strange situation. So anyway, all I can tell you is fasten your seatbelt and hold on. I've got a bit of an update here on sinkholes. Now, I've covered sinkholes before on this show. A year ago, 2 years ago, I don't know all of the different shows, but I've talked about sinkholes. 13% of the Earth's surface, I was surprised to find this out, 13% of the Earth's surface is affected by sinkholes. That's where the ground that we're walking on, which seems to be stable, all of a sudden just falls into a hole. And so where are these holes coming from? It was, a couple years ago I reported on Bryce Canyon. It's is that in Arizona or is that in Utah? I forget. I think it's in Utah. And by the way, if you hear some noise in the background, I'm not in my studio. I'm off on an assignment, which I give myself to do. And so I'm not in my nice, quiet studio. You may hear a bit of background noise. Sinkholes. There are some more dramatic sinkhole regions. They're called karst areas. There's one in Puerto Rico, and I think the other one is like in Hungary. You could correct me if I'm wrong there, but it's in like Eastern Europe, one of the Eastern Europe countries. The karst areas are basically limestone. Limestone is under the ground, and after rain and over the centuries and millennia, the limestone leaches away, and so it just leaves literally a hole in the ground, and eventually the ground just falls through and leaves these pillars. And so in Puerto Rico, that's what they use to build the Arecibo telescope, the great big stationary disc radio antenna used for astrophysics and astronomy in the in central mountain area of Puerto Rico. It's one of the famous karst areas of the world. But a bit closer to home, Florida is famous, various parts of Florida are famous for sinkholes. And they have the same situation where they have limestone. They have a number of factors there. But get this, Beijing, China, they're now measuring, is dropping by about 4 inches, they say 11 centimeters per year. So that's a little over, that's about 4 1/4 inches to be exact per year. And it's due to pumping of underground water. So anyway, there's a lot of private wells that are in Beijing. And so as you pump the water out, of course, you lose support for the ground. And they say it's a real problem for the rail systems there, because I imagine what's going on, these are high-speed rail systems moving rapidly, but they start having undulating track, and the tracks are falling, and certainly not evenly. And so it becomes a more of a problem for the train systems, their transportation system. But anyway, Beijing, China has a problem with the dropping of the surface area dropping. And but Florida, they're pumping water. And now these are man-made events. The karst regions are natural. And so there's many, I believe Tennessee, Virginia, there's many states in the United States. Florida's the worst, of course, but there's many states in the United States where there are sinkholes. There's the story in Florida of a guy who was sleeping and his whole house fell into a hole. And from what I understand, the whole house fell into this hole. If you've ever been in Florida, some of these regions, you'll see houses cracked or corners of a house just falling in, or people have stories of the living room floor sinking. And then, of course, to fix it, they have to come in, and there's procedures that they follow to prop up the house and support it. But it doesn't give you a very stable feeling. It's the old story of building your house on sand. But what's going on in Florida is they're pumping water into the Tampa area from the north. And, of course, the water, it's like the water on the sand on the beach. If you walk right along the sand on the beach where the water comes up and moistens the sand, it's hard. It's just like cement. You can drive your car on it. But up a few feet away, you walk on the loose, dry sand, and you sink in, and it changes shape, etc. So that's what's going on in Florida. So you have the leaching of the limestone underneath that goes all the way down to bedrock, which I understand is 100, sometimes 100 feet or more under the surface. Oh, so that's one effect. And, of course, it rains a lot in Florida. And then the sand being dry no longer has any strength, so it just sinks down in. So sinkholes are becoming more prominent in Florida. And it was a problem before, but now that they're pumping the water, tremendous amounts of water out of the aquifers that sit below some of these areas, they are becoming much worse. Anyway, by the way, I'm going to have a few more announcements here, but by the way, my main science topic tonight, I'm going to take you back to the mid-1970s to see what was going through my mind and my theoretical work back then that led up to the creation of the various theoretical work, things like that, gelled when I was at Cornell University, when the data was coming in from all over the place. And it was that point where I realized, oh my goodness, these scientists are off in la-la land, and my theoretical work was central to everything that I was seeing. So I'll take you back to the mid-1970s, give a little bit of history, and then also some theoretical observations on the basis of everything we're seeing today. First, a quick announcement. On my webpage, I've got various things now that I'm promoting, and I'm very selective. So I've got carrot bars there. You know, it's I would say about once every few days, every maybe once a week or a couple days, every few days, somebody signs up for carrot bars. And so the first thing is they would get an email with information. But there's basically two types of people that sign up for carrot bars: those that want to buy carrot bars for their for themselves, and those that want to make a business out of carrot bars. Carrot bars is an excellent business. It's a very well designed business, but it's growing by leaps and bounds internationally, and their gold costs a bit more than gold if you went to the gold store. But the thing about carrot bars is their buyback price is higher than the buy price of gold at the gold store. So if you think, oh, well, I get a better price at the gold store, ask them when you're buying the gold how much you're going to lose when you sell it back to them, because the gold by itself is not worth anything unless you change it back to some form of currency. And so holding gold is okay, but in many places also they don't even have the gold. They'll tell you, okay, buy it today, give us the money, and in 6 months you'll get the gold. And many people never get the gold. They get a piece of paper. Be that as it may, carrot bars, you do have the gold. You hold it yourself. It's in gram amounts, so it's in an amount. It's not by the ounce. It's by the gram. So it's something that everybody can afford. And as a member of Carrot Bars, I have personally, I've purchased carrot bars there, but my carrot bars come from my monthly commissions. And so I just hold the carrot bars, and it has very good commissions. And so here's something I learned a long time ago. You have what I call multiple streams of income. Some do good 1 month. Others do good in a different month. But all in all, you have these various streams of income coming in, and it's you know, it's a way of living in the modern world. I have a product called Via Viente, which is a super product developed in Ecuador, in the southern regions where the people live to ages over 100 years. And the doctor who studied this created Via Viente. And it has live food in it. And so you take a little capsule every day. And the people that I know that are doing this, they're doing wonderful. They're very healthy. And it's, you know, it provides you, because the problem is that the food today really is lacking. So if you're looking for a supplement, I think you should look into Via Viente. In addition, it's a very good business. It pays an excellent commission on sales. And so, at any rate, that's another product there. And I want to talk about PermaCube. PermaCube, I think this is such a fantastic idea. It's a patented process, and it's new. It's a baby product in terms of being on the market. What it is, it's a complete home food system that you put in your backyard. You can change your 401k. If you have a 401k, you can take some of the money from your 401k and buy a PermaCube. It's actually legal. And so I guess there's some new rules that you can buy commercial property with your 401k. There's various new rules. But you could buy a PermaCube, have your own food for basically for life. And what it is, it's a greenhouse. It's a central cube, which is a processing area. Then it has tanks for aquaculture, for fish, or you could have shrimp or something like that. Then there's for area for chickens, which is movable. It's with wheels, so you can actually move it around. And all of your recycling, whether it's scraps from the table or whatever, go into a recycling bin, are turned into compost, and then that's used in the soil. So it's a process that's really well thought out. You can have solar panels. My water filters are part of the system now, so that you will have clean water for your systems, because if you have glyphosates and chloramine and chloride and fluoride and you know, all of pharmaceutical drugs, all of this stuff that's in your water, then all that's going to be in your food. So you got to get rid of all of that. So you need filtered water to produce all of this. So it's a beautiful system. It's one that you put in your backyard, and it produces all your protein. You have eggs, you have chickens for meat, you have fish, you have any other aquaculture product that you want, plus all your vegetables and fruits and berries, things like that, all growing in the greenhouse part. And as you continue growing, you're going to have more and more compost, so you can expand this, have a little garden next to it, etc. But really, really a super idea called PermaCube. And my water filters, of course, are there, JMCC water filters. I don't have to say a lot about them. They're the best in the world. And my filter elements, remember, fit all other makes and models of water filters. No matter what model, make, or model you bought over the past 20 years, whatever that make or model, you can put my gravity water filter elements in there and upgrade today. And I have reports of this all the time. It's my biggest selling item, is replacing other people's or other brand worn out water filter elements. The thing about mine is that they take everything out in one filter element. There are no add-on filters. I used to sell add-on filters. They don't last very long. They're good for 300 to 400 gallons of water. Then you change them for they only take out arsenic and fluoride. My filters take out this huge laundry list, the glyphosates, the chloramines, the chlorine, the fluoride, the arsenic, and pharmaceuticals and VOCs, the volatile chemicals. Just a huge long laundry list, all taken out in one filter element. No add-ons. The add-ons are really expensive when you really add that in. So plus, mine do not require priming. That's where you pump the water backwards through the filter. That contaminates the filter. So my advice is, don't ever buy a filter that requires priming. How are you going to prime a filter in an emergency situation? You're going to take some polluted water and push it backwards through your filter? Oh, my goodness. Anyway, and then all my books, CDs, DVDs, posters, and the Recalendar Sun Star Clock, one of my prized inventions. Somebody just sent me a link for the Astrolabe, which is a super complex Middle Ages device developed by the Moors in northern Africa for understanding time while they're traveling around the Mediterranean and coastal. They were coastal mariners around the Mediterranean. And so the astrolabe was developed for mariners so they could guide themselves at night. But my calendar, Recalendar Sun Star Clock, allows you to understand how the calendar works, the sun, etc. And then it's a clock, it's a calendar. And if there were ever a pole shift, or if ever we lost time, if there was an infrastructure collapse and your clock ran out of battery and, you know, et cetera, or your watch, eventually they're going to run out of a watch. Or if there were a pole shift, you could recalendar, rebuild the clock, and have your know when to plant, know when to harvest, which is really one of the most important things. The ancient civilizations that succeeded had the ability to recalendar. Now, one of my books called Surviving Planet X Passage has a method for building a calendar from a pile of rocks. It's something that we see all over the American Southwest and all over the world, where the natives knew how to build a calendar and clock using a pile of rocks. And so I reproduce that method in that book. But that's a bit primitive, and it's a bit hard to do. The Recalendar Sun Star Clock is a plate that's about the size, it's literally the 8.5 by 11. I made it that size so that it would be exactly the same size as a tablet would fit in your briefcase, in your carry-on bag, or whatever. And literally, I always carry one with me. I always carry a water filter. I always carry my calendar. And it's fun. I've had a lot of fun impressing people with the calendar. I set it up no matter where I am on the planet. Northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, it works. And then at night, there's a little disc that you use for the determining the calendar and clock also. So anyway, without going into a lot of detail, I'm very proud of that little product. Very inexpensive. It's $44. That includes shipping to the 50 states. The Emergency Recalendar Sunstar Clock. It allows you to determine the time and the date and a calendar. Not just a date, the calendar, the entire calendar into the future and into the past. And anywhere in the world at any time. So it's a wonderful little device. And it's great educational for kids because they learn how the sun works and the relationship to time and the calendar, etc. But anyway, that's on my webpage, jmccsci.com. And there you'll also find the link to the new sales page, which is just water filter stuff. And the old sales page is there, which has water filter stuff and my books, CDs, DVDs, the calendar, the posters, etc. JMCCSCI.com, seven letters. JMCCSCI.com. Anyway, back to the 1970s. Whoosh. That's a long time ago, but I can remember it like it was yesterday. I was actually in the mid-70s. I was not in the U.S. I was teaching in a foreign university in a foreign language. I was teaching physics, mathematics, and computer science. And later in my career, when I was back in the U.S., I taught astronomy at the university level for quite a few years. And had quite success. My classes grew and grew until they had to find bigger and bigger lecture halls. I think the last one I had 90 students in it, something like that. But at any rate, back to the 1970s, I was, let's go back even to the 1960s when I was in college. That kind of dates me. I don't like doing that. But so I'm in college in the late 60s. The Apollo program is going on. We had all of the spec books for the Apollo spacecraft, the Saturn V rockets. We had all of these in the physics department. We had a really good physics department. It was called St. Mary's College, Winona, Minnesota. And a guy named Dr. Morgan was head of the department. He made sure we had good equipment. And we did something in that physics department. We created all our own experiments. So if we did the Michelson-Morley experiment, if we did the charge on the electron experiment, whatever it was, we literally built the experimental apparatus, cut the wires, found the power supplies that would work. So it was a real educational experience. And that particular fact got me in a bit of trouble. That was the beginning of my problems when I was at Cornell, because I worked in the my first assignment in the department of when I was at Cornell was this was before school started, was to organize the electronics lab. And this was the guy's pride and joy. He thought this was the best thing because all the wires were cut. All of the power supplies were in the bin. Each student or pair of students had their own bin. And so they would come in, take the stuff out of the bin, connect the wires, do their measurement. In 1 hour, they'd be done and out of there, and they'd go home, write up their experimental results. And my job was to make sure all the power supplies were working, that they, you know, everything, the wires were cut to the right length and everything like this. And so anyway, the guy who's the head of this electronics department, this is for undergraduate electronics, he comes in and I told him, I said, I didn't think this was a good educational experience for the students. I mean, they're paying this kind of money for their super education at Cornell. And I said, this is like coming in and having all of a cooking course and having all the flour measured and the eggs broken in a little dish and everything like that. And you come in, you throw it all in one thing, throw it in the oven, cook it, and you're done. I said, this is, you know, they should be deciding which rheostat to use, which wires to use based on the amount of current and the power load and the distance. And they would have to think and determine which wires to use, because this is all very important. But this was all done for them. So I told the guy, probably not the most tactful thing to do, but I never was great with tact, believe me. When I thought something, I said it. And 9 times out of 10, I got in trouble, which was the case here. And so anyway, I told the guy, I said, you know, I don't think this is a very good educational experience for, you know, physics students in electronics to have all the wires cut, etc. He looked at me like I had just, I don't know what. It was the worst thing. I just insulted him to the core. Because that was his pride and joy, having all of that in order, in, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so anyway, he didn't like that. He didn't like my criticism. So he was one of the instigators who got me in trouble and started raising problems there with me, with the astronomy department, because he happened to be aware that I was writing papers. Because, you know, I'd have my work with me, I'd have it there on the table. And so anyway, he was one of the ones that started instigating problems against Jim McCanny. And of course, once the astronomy department got wind of the fact that I was writing papers which were proving their theories incorrect using their data, the roof came off. The head of the physics department called me in. He told me, you cannot publish this anymore. Your work is banned. You cannot use Cornell's name anymore with your publications. We have complaints from the astronomy department that what you're doing here is totally incorrect and it's not allowed anymore. And so they had a woman, a PhD, I think her name was Mrs. Robinson. Her job was to follow me around so that I wouldn't talk to students. And so anyway, I then was basically terminated after that semester, not renewed is what it's called. And so I walked across campus and I got rehired by the mathematics department. So when you see my published papers, they have J.M. McCanny, Department of Mathematics, Cornell University, because the mathematics department loved the fact that I was publishing in astrophysics journals, peer-reviewed astrophysics journals. But the believe the second paper that I published there was called Saturn Sweeper Moons Predicted. And the object of that paper was to encapsulate all of my electric universe work. And by the way, that is a term I coined. You'll find it in my writing back then, very much copied today by many people. But it was a term that I developed to encapsulate what I was the central core theme of my work. And so, at any rate, let's go back into the 1970s, like I say, back to the 60s. When I was a physics student in college, this is before I went to get my advanced degree in physics at Tulane, I was at St. Mary's College. I had a double major in physics and mathematics, so I have a mathematics degree also. So, by the way, I was working on my Calculate Prime stuff back then. It just took many decades to formulate my final conclusion, which is published now in my book Calculate Primes. But back in the 60s, I was working on what was known as the three-body problem. It's a problem typically harbored in the area of gravity, where you have multiple planets. If you have a planet and a sun, for example, or a sun and a second sun, or two objects in gravitationally bound, understanding the orbits is very simple, and it's a closed analytical form. The equation's very simple. It can tell you where these objects are going to be at any point in time in the future. It's a closed analytical, this is the term they use, analytical, in other words, equations, closed form solution. But you add a third body and the roof comes off. There's no closed form solution, which seems a bit nonsensical, but that's the case. So I thought, okay, this is a major requirement in physics, because here we live in a solar system with nine planets, and yes, there are still nine planets, even though they voted one of them isn't a planet. No, there's still literally hundreds of planets now that have been discovered. But so as soon as you put that third body in there, the analytical solutions go away. They don't work anymore, and nobody has ever found a way to find to locate a closed form analytical solution to the motion of these, because they get very complex. So at any rate, I thought, well, there's got to be a way to do this, a new technique, a new form of mathematics, a new technique that we're just not familiar with. And so that's what I was hunting for. And by the way, that's what led to the solution of the prime number problem, because it was the prime number problem was very similar in that where you if you hear some noise in the background, yeah, there's some there's going to be some noise here. Prime number solution, when I finally solved it, I thought, you know, I'm not going to start at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I'm not going to start with the low numbers and go up to, you know, big, big numbers. I'm going to jump into the middle of the prime number table, and that's when the solution hit me. And it's very similar to what I was doing with the three-body problem in physics. Because what do you have? You have, like, say, in a planetary system, we have ten planets probably, and a sun. And here we are in the middle of its motion. I mean, it's already happening. We don't have a starting point of when it started or anything like that. Here we are in the middle of it. So I jumped into the middle of the prime number table using the same techniques I had developed for the three-body problem, and that's what led to the solution of the calculate primes, the solution of directly calculating prime numbers, which also wasn't real welcome by the standard communities because it broke the RSA codes. By the way, there's been a rash of orders recently of my book, Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. So I'm not sure. And these are international orders. Yeah, these orders are coming all over. So maybe somebody mentioned something on a radio show. I'm not sure even. But anyway, a rash of orders for my book. This is the follow-on book to Calculate Primes. It's called Breaking RSA Codes for Fun and Profit. Or Fun with Dick and Jane. Anyway, you can see that on my webpage, on the sales page. A very interesting little book that really everybody should read. But, okay, so back to the three-body problem. So what I was looking for was a new mathematical method, because the old methods, you know, certainly had been exhausted to the extent of their ability to solve problems. And you could have closed solutions for very limited three-body problems, or n-body problems, as it's called. And you could have very limited solutions or approximations or solutions that work for a short period of time. Or you could do the old trick of the modern version using computers. Excuse me. And that's what NASA does when they go on space ventures. They have engineers who calculate orbits. And then they send out using their best estimate of where to go. And then they have mid-course corrections where they change the orbit a bit as the object is moving out to one of the outer planets, say, for example, etc. Okay, so here we are back in the 60s, and I imagined a concept. I said, what if we lived in a universe in which there were huge forces, huge energetic processes going on that somehow we were buffered from, that we really didn't experience. It would be like you're in this capsule and there's this huge, tremendous wind blowing or something, you know, that and so that, but somehow this affected us also. And literally that was something that came to be true with the solar wind. Now, back in the early days of astronomy, when it first became known that there was a solar wind, it first was assumed that that solar wind had to be neutral because of a very simple problem in plasma physics. It's one of the first problems that you will encounter if you go into advanced physics, into the region known as plasma physics. And this is under the guise of what is known as Chapman physics. It was what Chapman was the guy who kind of ruled the roost in the United States, where Hans Alphen was more in the European vein. The Chapman physics said that there had to be electrically neutral outer space. And it was almost like a religious dogma starting point that space had to be electrically neutral. And this is why. If you took plasma, which is just charged particles in outer space floating around freely, they tend to fall into an equilibrium state. They tend to arrive at an equilibrium state very quickly. In other words, if there's a charge area over here, then say a negatively charged, then very quickly the positive charge would come in and neutralize it to the extent possible. And so space would literally be uniform electrically. Or if you, say, took a charged particle, and these are thought experiments, you all of a sudden you took a charged particle, you could imagine it all of a sudden appearing, let's say it was a negatively charged particle, and you all of a sudden it appears in the middle of this plasma. Well, that would set up, upset the balance of charge in that region, and all of the positive charge would move to that region to balance it out, and eventually you would have a balanced charge. And so, anyway, the theoretical observation was that space had to be electrically neutral. So they carried this to its logical conclusions that there could be nothing electrical, and this is what they used to slam dunk Velikovsky, who was saying, hey, you know, the ancients are talking about lightning bolts in the sky, they're talking about, you know, clearly some electrical types of things through observations, through historical record. And he didn't know what may have caused it, just like Tesla. Tesla, back in the early 1900s, knew how to tap into the vertical electric field. And by the way, he was not transmitting his electricity through the air. He was transmitting it through the ground. These Colorado Springs experiments are very definitively based on the electrical current being transmitted through the ground and being collected by his tower. So all of the movies, all of the internet misinformation on Tesla towers where he's trying to transmit through the air is total garbage. Tesla was transmitting electrical current through the ground, collecting it from the air. But there again, he didn't know where this was coming from. He did not know about the solar wind. He did not know about what I know, the differential solar wind, in which there is an excess current of protons in the solar wind, which creates that positive charge in the far reaches of the solar system. He didn't know about any of this. He just knew how to tap into it. Okay, and he knew about frequencies, and he knew about the Earth frequency. He knew about a lot of things. And that's why in my Atlantis to Tesla book, I talk about the fact that Tesla, his father was a curator of the museum in, was it Kosovo? I forget. In the place that Bill Clinton blew up. Billy Clinton sent in a bunch of cruise missiles and blew up the church where Tesla's father worked with the museum in it. What a bunch of doofuses. The Clintons have nothing. You know, Billy has nothing to sit there and chortle about. He is one of the biggest doofuses to ever crawl out from under a rock. and of course buddies with the Bushes, who have left a trail of disaster and destruction in their path also. But anyway, yeah, it was Billy Clinton's idea to destroy the church where Tesla's father worked, with the museum in the basement. Real smart, Bill. Real smart, Bill. Yeah, those are people that have earned their lowest level of hell particular room, all designed for them, because they got their reward on Earth. There's going to be something waiting for them at the end of this pipe, believe me. Okay, but at any rate, sorry about that diversion. Back to the show here. So back to the 1970s, I started for the fun of it, including electric and magnetic fields in my N-body theoretical work. So I'm working with N-body problems with gravity. I'm understanding how the gravitational fields combine, what the combined gravitational fields look like, what I call the circle of equal force. It's a very interesting thing if you take two gravitational bodies, one big, one small. If they're the same size, then the circle of equal force is actually a line that's right between them. But as if one is smaller, then the region at which the gravitational forces are exactly equal, in other words, if you put a test point there, that it would not know which way to go, whether it would go towards the smaller object or towards the bigger one. Inside that circle, it would move towards the smaller one. Outside that circle, it would move towards the bigger one. And so it's just a kind of a defining point. And I determined that that was a circle. And nobody had ever done that before in celestial mechanics. That was one of the first realizations. And then how the rays of gravitational attraction would work, the combination of the gravitational fields. And then also you have to add in rotational dynamics and a bit of other physics. But what I did is I said, okay, what if by some process these objects also had charges and magnetic fields? What is all this going to look like? And so all of a sudden things got pretty complicated. But I made some major realizations. Just like the test point for the gravitational fields in the circle of equal force, which you can find in my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes. It's all explained in there. And you can see the pictures and the diagrams. And these are from my early publications, too. It has some of my early publications in the appendices from the late 1970s, and etc. So there were similar properties that went along with the electrical systems, but they were different, a bit more complicated. So at any rate, I said, well, if we had other test particles out there, what would happen? What if we threw in a fourth object or a fifth object and it was big or it was small? And so I went, when you do this in physics, you go down all the way to the smallest object and go up to bigger and bigger objects. And what I realized is that small charged particles with low mass, high charge to mass ratio, like electrons, ions, dust particles with a charge on them, would move relatively quickly. But the electrons, their next competitor was the proton, which was 2,000 times more massive. So I realized something extremely important, which is one of the core realizations of my work, is that in any electrical discharge in outer space, the electrons are going to be the primary charge carrier. They are going to move the fastest, and the bulk charge carrier. And so what's going to happen? So then literally what I'm telling you here is all of this theoretical work I had rolling around in my brain, on my paper, in my notes, in my development, and here I come into Cornell University, 1979. I'm in the physics department, and I'm going to the library every day and studying the ancient text. Cornell had a Library of Congress, an excellent, excellent library up in the Astronomy Space Science Building, which was set apart up in the upper part of campus. And also access to the after school meetings where all the space data was coming in. 2-3 meetings a day many times where the various data from various space probes was coming in. And I could sit in on these and I could see the data and I'm going, oh my goodness, all my theoretical work is in the data. And then I realized that these bozos, these NASA scientists, had no clue what they were looking for. So what did they do? They scuttled the data. They didn't publish it. They didn't know what to do. They pretended like it wasn't there. They came up with gravitational arguments for why certain things happened. And anyway, the crux of the issue is, okay, the spacecraft are starting to approach Saturn. And I looked into the rings of Saturn and I said, oh man, you know what? There are electrical moons in here. They're discharging the capacitor at Saturn. Saturn is a small star. Saturn has surface fusion. It has its own proton wind. And these little moons are little comets. And so I had already developed the plasma discharge comet model, the electrical discharge of the solar capacitor. Saturn was its own little star with its own capacitor. These moons are discharging it. The rings, here was one of the tricks in understanding this, is that the rings of Saturn, and you can look on my webpage, I have a bunch of pictures, repeated pictures of Saturn's rings. You will find that the rings are very sharp on the outside of the ring, and on the inside of the next ring, they fade very gradually. Well, this is the comet effect, in which the nose is very sharply defined in a comet on the sunward side, or in this case, the Saturn side, and the tail extends outward. So, and then you could see where some of the rings only faded in a certain area, which indicated to me that the moons were coming in at an angle. And so I set about writing the paper, Saturn Sweeper Moons Predicted. And that is such a seminal paper. That is such a key paper because it came at a time when, believe me, nobody had a clue what was going on in the electrical universe. Nobody had even dreamt of the things, the processes. And so what I was able to do was, from a source of physics, mathematics, and understanding, I was able to predict the moons at Saturn. And it's exactly what happened. Eventually, all those moons have been discovered. But, of course, nobody wants to give me credit for it because still a little bit of bad sour grapes there over at the Cornell Space Science Department, Astronomy Department. But anyway, be that as it may, they were wrong, I was right. And so that's the historical record, which is certainly not the first time in history that something like that has happened. Boy, I'm out of time here. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And remember, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, and check it out. 6+ gigabytes of information there. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.